Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by Gail Schimmel. Hi Gail.
Hi Fiona.
Gail, how has your writing week been?
So I have this week given myself a stern talking to that I really do need to finish this book that I'm working on at some point of my life, and it may as well be this point, and that I need to get to the end because I'm on 67,000 words. The end is in sight. I need to figure out how this book ends and end it. Mm. And I sat down with all these good intentions and I wrote three very good sentences. And the last of the very good sentences says something like, and he knew exactly what he had to do. The problem was I had no idea what he had to do. But it was a very good sentence. And so then I went and I stood in my kitchen and I said to myself, you will not think what it is he needs to do, and you will not do anything until you have thought of it. And you're not going to believe it, but it worked.
Wow.
And I knew what he had to do. And now I have to write the end of that book. How has your writing been?
Well, I'm still faffing about with my new idea that I've been talking about, and I've kind of crystallized it at this point to five scenes, five things that happened over a number of years. And it felt as though initially there was a great deal of energy behind those five scenes. But then I realized I've got a premise, but I don't actually have a plot.
Ah.
And as we've talked about before, a premise is a starting idea. It's a setting. It might be some characters. It's a world that you know you're going to inhabit, but you don't actually know what's going to happen. You don't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. When you have those things, you have an actual plot. So I'm at that premise stage. I've got five scenes, five things that happened, not evenly spread throughout time, but you know, some of them come on top of each other and some are spread far apart. It's a premise, not a plot, and I need to turn it into a plot before I know whether this is actually going to go anywhere.
And you know what I'm going to tell you to do?
Mm.
Complicate it. Complicate it.
Okay.
And that for me is how you get from a premise to a plot, is you complicate it.
Yes. I need some complicating factors because at the moment it's very static. It's not going anywhere.
Hopefully by next week, Fiona, you'll have thought of some complications and you'll tell us that you have broken ground on a new book.
I hope so. Let's really hope so.
What have you been reading or watching that might inspire you in that regard?
I've been reading some really great books lately. When I'd finished the Wally Lamb that I read last week, I thought to myself that I really want to revisit Maggie O'Farrell because I am a fan. I've read a few of her books. I couldn't face Hamnet because I just couldn't face dead babies at the moment. Too traumatic, although I believe it is brilliant. So I went back to an older one of hers called This Must Be the Place. And she is just so good. You know, she writes quite long and a little bit literary, but she draws you in immediately. She's such a good plotter. Her characterization is so brilliant. Her writing is so immediate. After two sentences, you already care about these people. Mm. It's such a gift. And when I'm reading, I'm thinking to myself, how does she do it? How does she do it? What are her secrets? And trying to mine the narrative for the secrets.
It's so interesting because for me, she's one of those writers who there's certain writers who the moment you start reading them, you have that feeling of being picked up by safe hands.
Yes.
And you know that you can trust them to take you along and that you will enjoy every moment of the ride and they will look after you.
Yes.
And for me, Maggie O'Farrell is very, I start a book of hers and I go, except for Hamnet. I start a book of hers and I go, yes, here I am.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I want readers to have that feeling from my book. So I'm just thinking,
but how do we do it? How do we do it? I do not know.
It's the eternal question. What have you been consuming lately?
So I have stayed a little bit in the supernatural world. Last week I talked to you about witches, and this week I'm going to talk to you about ghosts.
Mm.
And one of the books I've read recently that I really, really loved was a book called Aftertaste by Daria Lavelle, L-A-V-E-L-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book, I think it's appearing on a lot of the lists, because I'm going through a bit of a read the lists phase. And I think it's a debut, but I don't want to swear to that. It is a book about a man who connects with ghosts through food.
Mm-hmm.
So two of my favorite things, ghosts and food. And what happens is, and he always has had this ability, he will get a taste in his mouth. So he'll meet you and then a taste will come in his mouth and it's a ghost connected to you trying to make contact with you.
Mm-hmm.
And he grows up and he discovers that if he cooks the taste, then the ghost will come. So that, I love that premise.
Yes.
But then it gets complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's a spoiler to say how it gets complicated, but summoning ghosts turns out to not be entirely the good thing, because when he first does it, it brings closure to the people who the ghost was trying to make contact with.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a complication. And it does get a little bit mad and a little bit surreal fantasy, but I really loved it. For me, that mixture of food and ghosts was just lovely.
I like that. I'm very tempted by that, yes. Well, someone else who knows how to take a plot and complicate it is our guest today. Our guest today is Tom Eaton. Tom is the author of The De Villiers Code, Texas, The Wading, 12 Rows Back, Is It Me or Is It Getting Hot in Here? And now most recently, An Act of Murder, published in 2025 by Penguin Random House. It's on the shelves right now and is being very well received. Tom, we are so delighted to get to talk to you at last. Hello and welcome.
Hello, and what an absolute pleasure to be here.
Tom, I don't know if you're a regular listener to the podcast or not. I'm starting to feel that people might be, but we are going to jump into what we always jump into and ask you, how has your writing week been?
Well, I do listen to you guys, and I know that you talk about your writing week, and sometimes I feel very shamed by the fact that you've had a writing week. When you say, oh, it's going really badly, I've only managed to do, 4 days out of the seven. Yes, you set the bar quite high. No, my writing week is always a bit of a chaotic thing because I do write a lot. I write 2 columns a week. I'm now doing a third for my personal Substack, and then I have the second Arnold Prinsloo book is ticking along. So the writing week's been a sort of I want to say moving from one thing to the next, but it's felt more like veering or staggering from one thing to the next. But this week it's been heavily dominated by the column writing, and the book has taken a slight backseat.
This is something I'm actually always very interested in. So I was going to ask this question further down the line, but it always seems to me if your day job is writing columns and your other job is writing books, it pulls from the same energy instead of different energies. Is that correct? Or do you find that it's using up the same part of you doing all the different types of writing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I think, the more I do it, the less clear I get on it all. I'm much less dogmatic in my views about all the stuff than I used to be. But the best answer I think I can give you for now is that they don't come from the same place. The column writing has to come from a kind of performative, front-brained energy. It has to be... I suppose the easiest way to describe it is column writing is banter, informed, and you try and be intelligent. Whereas the fiction writing is meditation, is quiet conversations with somebody with whom you have a shorthand. It doesn't have necessarily the same performative element. So I think they do come draw on slightly different energies. Having said that, they do require the same 4 fingers on the keyboard. I'm a 4-finger typer. And so I think, yes, there can be a little element of feeling, here we are again. But I am finding that they use quite different energies, which is great, because I don't think I would be able to write the books on the side with the day job as it is.
And can you break your day down for us? Do you work from home? And how do you, when you are in the thick of writing a novel, how do you divide up your time so that you're getting the two columns, the Substack, the novel, getting everything done in a week? Like, really break it down for us.
So remember at high school, there were those kids, and maybe you were those kids, who highlighted things in different colors and had little post-its and little stickers to show the different parts of the file. I envied those kids so intensely for their ability to be disciplined and to think in organizational ways. I am the antithesis of that. I am a creature that sits in a heap until the deadline demands that the adrenaline starts pumping, at which point a combination of performance anxiety and adrenaline shoves me through. So, well, that has been the case in the past. So the writing day is heavily deadline dependent. I have reached a point now with my columns where I can't start them early, for obvious reasons. You know, the news changes quickly, but also you find that your mind wanders to new ideas. So if my column I have to submit at 6 p.m. on a Monday evening, if I started that on Friday, by Saturday morning, I'd think, I've got a different idea now, actually. So I leave the columns as late as I can, and then you are locked in. One of my columns goes into business day, so there is a blank sheet of physical paper waiting at the printers in Joburg or wherever they printed for my words, and that is an incredible motivation. There's a story that I like. Years ago, there was a Vietnam fighter pilot called, I think he was called Randy Duke Cunningham. And in an interview, he was talking about what it's like to be shot at with a surface-to-air missile. And he, being an American fighter pilot, was very cool about it all. And he said, well, you know, the first thing you do is you check who it's coming for. You check your radar, who is it coming for. And if it's coming for your wingman, then you feel okay. You feel good. If it's coming for you, you don't feel as good, but it sure does rearrange your priorities. And I think that... I've become a little bit dependent in a way of having those priorities rearranged for me by deadlines. I know writers love comparing themselves to like fighter pilots in life and death situations, and we accept it's not nearly that severe. But I do think I am a bit of an adrenaline addict in that sense. But in terms of the fiction writing days, I'm trying to write in the morning first thing, because the mind is clearer, and I think things come more easily. The day hasn't piled up on you yet, but I am also a night owl, so I'm sort of in this push pull situation where, the instinct is to stay up very late and bang away at 1 or 2 in the morning. But I'm not sure that I'm now, I think, too old to do that properly. You know, my brain has slowed down quite a lot, and so I think it's now morning or bust, really.
So in that time that is in the morning or possibly at night, and you sit down to write your novel, do you have a target of how much you're going to write? Is it an amount of words? Is it a particular scene? How do you decide what you're writing in that session?
So I think it's usually a combination of a number of words and a scene. So for instance, if my chapter, I've plotted out my chapters, what needs to happen and word count and all that. So if my chapter is 1,800 words, I think, well, what's feasible? I think I can have a shot at a third of the chapter today. I can give a stab at 600 words. They don't have to be perfect words, but I need to get through, let's say, 600, a third of the chapter. Okay, what narratively, what is a third of this chapter? Is it they walk from point A to point B and cover this content in the conversation? So yes, in the early stages, in the sort of structural construction of it all, it is quite sort of paint by numbers in a way. You know, get through X number of words covering this amount of material. Although I must say, writing for TV has helped me enormously in that regard, because in TV writing, the one thing you learn very quickly is there is no time for anything. There's no time for nonsense. You've got, if it's a half hour show, you've got 24 pages and a page in a script. There's almost no writing on it. It's 12, 15 lines essentially. So you get through what you need to say, which I think is a useful skill for me, because I do tend to digress. When I start writing a scene in which a conversation happens about, you know, a trip to the post office to, well, no, we don't have post offices anymore. Okay, a trip to the shops to buy milk. You know, it'll be halfway to the shop when he'll suddenly have a memory of another trip to a shop, which I will want to describe because I think it's funny and I think it's adds to the character. But TV has taught me, no, you don't have time for that. And B, it's not really necessary. Just tell the story and get on with it. So yes, I think I do work in these sort of manageable chunks. I think most writers are easily overwhelmed by the idea that, oh, you know, this chapter has to be 2,000 words. I've got to write 2,000 words. Where do I start? So I have learned now to break it down into smaller chunks, which is very helpful. And I suppose the column writing helps as well, because I've developed the muscle for writing. First, it was 900 words, then it became 800 words, currently 600 words, because attention spans. So, you know, you have a sense, a range-finding sense now. I do it twice a week. I write 600 words or sometimes 700 words twice a week. And so there's a certain sort of breath that you have. You know, I would imagine swimmers and sprinters and whatnot have the same breath. You know how much you're going to expend doing this, and you can manage it. Again, comparing myself to swimmers and runners, again, I'm just sitting typing at a keyboard. But it's a useful analogy.
It's so useful, I'm writing it down.
Tom, when you were younger, were you always going to be a humorous columnist and accidentally became a novelist? Or were you always going to be a novelist and accidentally went into writing columns?
Or were you going to be a dentist?
Or were you going to be something else entirely? How did it all come together?
Well, I think I first wanted to be a fighter pilot. And then I learned that you have to have be good at maths, and you need to be like 5 foot nothing to be a fighter pilot. So that was never on the cards. Then I said to my parents, maybe I should be a high school teacher like them. And they said, over our dead bodies, will you be a high school teacher like us? And then I thought advertising and like, anyway, but while I was thinking all these things, I was drifting into a BA with a focus on writing. And I think, I don't know if I can speak for all writers, but certainly in my case, I followed what came the most easily and what I got the most sort of validation for, in a way. Not validation necessarily, but sort of a positive response. You know, that sort of proprioception that you have in the world where there's a sort of a gentle yes one direction and a gentle no in another direction, you tend to go towards the gentle yes. And so that's how I ended up going kind of in this direction. And then I think by the time I'd reached, you know, my sort of late academic career doing a master's in creative writing, I think I did have an idea of being a novelist. Because, of course, the one thing they don't teach you at university and in an MA is that you can't be a novelist for a living in South Africa. So I thought, well, I'll do that. And then I think, you know, I had a good experience with JM Coetzee as my supervisor and that whole process. But I think I've always had this natural instinct to be, it's kind of you to say humorous. Some people call it snarky. When I was at the Frantic Literary Festival, I was on a panel with Rebecca Davis, and Rebecca's fantastic. And we were walking towards the venue, and she said, "So, like, I mean, like, what are you doing these days? You know, we all endlessly ask each other, like, what are you doing? How are you making a living?" She said, "What are you doing these days?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm keeping on with the satire." And she said, "Well, you don't really do satire, do you? I mean, it's more like snark." So I had to laugh. She's not wrong, but you know, whether you call it satire or snark, I was always drawn in that direction, especially or even as a kid. So yeah, I found that there was an outlet for it, and also I was incredibly lucky. You know, I think that's something that a lot of people don't talk about when they talk about careers and how things happen. Is luck plays an enormous role in all of it, and I was working at a internet cricket website. I was the guy who writes, you know, ball six, outside off stump, left alone. I was that guy. I became a bit bored with that. And so I wrote a column, sort of an annoyed response to something Tiger Woods had done. Somebody had painted a painting of Tiger Woods, and he had sued the artist. And I thought, well, that's a bit dickish. And so I'd written this out in a sort of snarky way. And I thought, well, let me send it somewhere. And at the time, the Mail and Guardian was in its full flower as the country's, you know, loveliest newspaper. So I sent it to them. And their sports editor, who is a fantastic woman called Julia Biffon, replied to me going, I like it, I'll publish it. And do you want to do another one next week? So I said, sure, I'll do another one next week. And I did another one next week. And then she said, well, do you want to do another one after that? And I said, sure. And then she stopped saying, do you want to do another one? And I just kept sending them. And so that's been my career. You know, I've never signed a contract in my life. I've just had, it's all been on the basis of, well, do you just want to keep going until we say no? And that was enormously lucky that Julia was there, that she was willing to you know, take the sports pages in that sort of direction. So luck has played an enormous role.
Tom, I want to go back a bit to process, because you said something in passing that we then walked past and I've written down. You said, obviously, I've plotted it out and I know the word count for the chapters, if that was obvious. And that's not obvious to me. So are you a plotter? Do you plot the whole book and know how long each chapter must be before you start?
So I think for this series of books, for these Arnold Prinsloo cozy crimes, I'm absolutely a plotter, because they are a sort of a mechanical object. You know, everything has to fit together, sort of a clockwork thing where you wind it up and then it unwinds and goes cuckoo at the end. You have to, I feel at least, that it needs to be quite carefully plotted and planned. I'm not sure that I'm naturally a plotter. My two novels that weren't parodies or satires, Texas and The Waiting, were the antithesis of plot, somewhat to their detriment. They just sort of rolled along and you know, I remember an agent or a publisher abroad, my publisher at the time took it overseas, and this publisher said, like, it's really lovely, but nothing happens. So I do think that left to my own devices, I might be a bit of a pantser, not a plotter. But certainly for these books, I've had to plot. And this next one, you know, is sitting with spreadsheets of, you know, who is where at what time, and figuring out the distances, and can you walk 1.5 kilometers in the 8 minutes required to, blah, blah, blah. Because it all has to unwind in a satisfying way. So for these, very much so. But I'm not sure that I will always be that.
That's so interesting. I want to talk about your take on why cozy crime is having a moment in South Africa right now. Because I know, as an author, that you're sitting alone and doing your own thing and coming up with your own ideas, and suddenly you find you're kind of part of a movement, that other people were doing the same thing at the same time. And we have the Tani Maria mysteries, we have Bonnie Espy's latest book, we have An Act of Murder. Where did it come from? Do you have an idea of why South Africans might be attracted to cozy crime, local cozy crime, right now?
Well, I have two different answers to that. The one is a sort of front-brained answer, and the other is not. So the answer as to why I did this book, you know, I don't know about Sally Andrew and Bonnie Espy, but I did this book purely because it was suggested to me by my publisher. She said, would you know, cozy crime is hot. Do you want to write a cozy crime? And it seemed like a fun challenge, a fun thing to do. It was essentially an offer of going on a little holiday in a new direction. So that's why I did it. As for why it's popular right now, I think... you know, crime fiction will always be compelling. I think all readers, or whether it's fiction, film, or television, or cinema, are drawn to, for want of a better word, dead bodies. I mean, we're animals, and animals all stop and stare at the dead one by the side of the watering hole, for all sorts of reasons. I'm sure it gives us some deep existential thrill that it was them and not us. You know, the way little children love to be frightened, you know, it fires up all kinds of things in us, but we're safe. We're sitting in our safe little house reading it and experiencing. So I think the thrill of danger is universal. As for the cozy crime part, I think there may be an element, especially in South Africa, which is a supremely violent society. I do think that perhaps there's a sense of a tinge of the real creeping into the violent, to the violence in crime writing. You know, when I and I say this with all respect to successful grim dark crime writers, but when I open a novel and there's, you know, a murdered woman lying on the side of the road, I'm like, this is, we've got enough of that in real life. Why are you adding to this pile of corpses with an imaginary one? And so that's why I think perhaps there's an element among readers wanting the thrill of crime, but without necessarily the harrowing ghastliness that is all too easy to encounter in the real world. Maybe that's a facile answer, I don't know, but that is my sense of it.
I agree, and I think it's probably actually also a bit of the reason behind the international rise of cozy fiction, that people just are not up for harsh reality at the moment.
I think also, you know, there's also an element of nostalgia. Nostalgia is extremely powerful, especially at the moment, I think, as the world seems quite chaotic and people look for older worlds, older iterations of the world. And you know, when people ask me what is cozy crime, like they've never heard of it and they're confused by it, I say, no, we all grew up with it. It's Murder, She Wrote, you know, which itself was a revival of a sort of Agatha Christie, Miss Marple thing. So I do think that there are these older iterations of it that we actually do know and take us back to those simpler, happier times. You know, the way that, you know, Harry Potter so spectacularly, successfully harked back to the, you know, the high school boarding school tropes of the 1920s and 30s and 40s, even though those kids might not necessarily have felt the nostalgia for those times that they didn't know, but it's there, it's in the culture.
I want to talk to you about writing humor, because across your writing, in varying degrees, humor is a big part of your writing, the satire, the snark. It's hard to write humor. What advice would you give to somebody trying to be funny in their writing?
I would say, I would quote Yoda and say, there is no try, there is just do. I think that by the time you start wanting to write humorously for an audience, you will know whether or not you can. There will be many, many indications throughout your life that there is an audience, an appreciative audience for this. If you haven't had that appreciative response, then perhaps don't do it. Don't start, because it's very, very hard to just sit down one day at, you know, 26 or whatever and go, well, I'm going to be funny now. There are some people who do it. I know quite a successful comedian who just one day decided he was going to be a comedian, and just by force of will and lots of research and hard work became a comedian. So you can do it. But I think writing comedically is something that you will naturally start doing. And if you haven't naturally started doing it, perhaps it's not for you. Which applies to any genre, frankly. I think not just comedy. I think we're all drawn to the genres we're drawn to. And I think, you know, I have another friend who endlessly sort of tears his hair out about the fact that, you know, writers make so little money. He's not a writer, but he has this sort of morbid fascination with us. And he keeps saying to me, but why don't you just write a, and then he will insert whatever the huge best-selling genre is at the time. So, you know, why don't you write a romanticy, for example? And my answer is that I physically can't. It's not snobbery. It's not I'm holding my nose. It is that I physically don't have it in me to sit down and write whatever it is, 200,000 words of leprechauns having sex. It's like you it comes naturally to you or it doesn't. And so I think that is the case with any genre. And I think this cozy crime, which didn't naturally come to me, the crime aspect didn't come to me. I think what's made it a pleasure is that it has the comedic aspect, it has the light aspect. It's a lovely container for, you know, character observations and a bit of comedy.
Let's talk about your main character in An Act of Murder, Arnold Prinsloo. And I have to stop myself from calling him Arnold Forsloo, which is actually a plot point in the novel. But he starts off as a real loser character. at the beginning of the novel, he's just losing one aspect of his life after another. So he's starting from a very low base, and he's got nowhere really to go except up. Why did that character arc attract you, and do you feel able to continue it, you know, to be a series?
So the response I've had from readers has been fascinating, I've been told things about him that I didn't necessarily recognize. So I knew that he was a bit of a loser, but the response I've had is, God, what an absolute loser. And I felt slightly offended on his behalf. Because of course there are lots of aspects of me in him, and I'm like, oh really, is he that much of a loser? I've also had quite a lot of women say he's so annoying.
Yes.
He's such an annoying main character, and then you learn to like him and root for him. And again, I thought, I mean, I know he's self-destructive and a bit of a thin-skinned, you know, prima donna, but annoying? I don't know about annoying, but it's been fascinating to hear those responses. In terms of his character arc, yeah, I think I like the idea of this guy, very, very self-defeating but somewhat delusional, having to learn some hard lessons about himself. You know, we all know those people. In fact, from time to time, we are those people who are just not taking the advice. And people have tried saying it nicely, and then people have had to say it more firmly, and we still haven't taken the advice. So he is that guy. And, you know, this is the enormous traumatic jolt in his life that perhaps puts him slightly more on the right path. And I think throughout the course of an act of murder, Arnold does learn how to grow up in a few respects. As for a series, yes, this is a series. There's at least one more coming. And I'm hoping to continue that learning arc. You know, there are ways to take him back a step, because I think with all personal growth, it's two steps forward and one step back. And so in the second book, I think he definitely will have taken half a step back, and we won't be starting from first principles again, but he definitely has to learn new things. And then a third book, I think, you know, you will know that you start really liking your main character, or all your characters, but especially your main character. You really start feeling them like that they're a bit of a friend. And so, you know, my hope for the third book is to give him everything he wants. I mean, what is fiction but sort of escapist fantasy? And if I can't do this lovely thing for this person that I've put in a ghastly situation, you know, what's it all for? So I'm hoping that it will be a sort of three-part character arc in which he comes out at the end older, wiser, better, and happier.
Let's talk about that planning a series. I want to know, first of all, if you knew from the beginning that you were writing a series, or if you thought, I'll try one and then see. And then the other thing, you've just said a three-part arc, and I'm a bit stunned by that, because as a cozy mystery writer, I know you mustn't only look at a three-part arc. You must keep writing them until people stop buying them. So are you clear that it's three-part, or are you going to see what happens?
No, I'm very clear that it's three parts. I think if I loved cozy crime in my heart of hearts, if it nourished me, I could happily do it forever. But it does feel like a very fun, informative, healthy course of like gym and yoga for me. You know, it's something that you, I feel like it's making me a better person in all sorts of ways, but I will stop doing it at some point. And I think three feels right. Listen, never say never. And, you know, should the series take off and become gigantically successful, and, you know, I can organically and happily think of more things for Arnold to do. I do think, though, that my premise slightly limits it. You know, there's only so many times a person who's not a detective can be exposed to murders before readers start going, well, I mean, not, you're shaking your head.
I'm shaking my head. Cozy readers will accept as many murders as you throw at your main character. I can promise you, they will never lose belief that your character can stumble over a body every 10 minutes and nothing makes them question that.
Okay. Well, then I leave this entirely open. I leave this in the hands of the fictional murder gods.
So you set out knowing that you were writing cozy crime. how constrained did you feel by the conventions of that genre? Because, you know, normally it's a small village setting. There's very often a female sleuth. Mm. She might be young. She might be elderly. There often are some adorable animals involved. The gore level is not high. It's not revolting. A murder has to happen pretty early on. If not in chapter one, well, then soon afterwards. And then there's a kind of sleuthing process, interviewing suspects. They've got to be multiple suspects. They've got to be red herrings. Now, Bonnie Espy's book is not like that. It defies the conventions. And so does your book. Did you know you were defying conventions, or did you just write your own thing?
I was faced with a choice right at the beginning, which was to read as much cozy crime as I could or read no cozy crime. And I took the option to read no cozy crime, partly because I'm lazy, but also partly because I thought it might actually influence me. It might actually discourage me, because I think there is an instinct where you go, oh, well, it's all been done. You know, the more you read, the more you go, oh, well, I can't do that, and I can't do that, and I can't do that, and I shouldn't do that. So I decided to sort of isolate myself from the genre as much as I could. I knew there were certain requirements, like some of those you've described. And so I just launched. Problematically, I wasn't getting it right initially. I did go in a wrong direction. The murder was happening far too late. It was far too, not literary. Literary is the wrong word, but there was a lot of interior monologue from Arnold. There was a lot of thinking about, it was a bit neurotic. It was a kind of neurotic first 20,000 words, and it was just wrong for the genre, because, you know, we need action and meat on the bones. So once I did that, I could step away a little bit and go, okay, well, what are the conventions? But still, without reading more, just what are the conventions? And so I sort of managed to pull myself closer towards the conventions. But yeah, I think it was a process of seeing where I could take it based on the sort of 4% whiff of anecdotal evidence I had about cozy crime. And then now and then I would have to touch in with reality. And my publisher actually stepped in at one point, because I don't think it's a spoiler now to say that for a sizable chunk of the writing of the first draft, there actually wasn't going to be a murder. it was kind of going to be a mix-up, essentially. And my publisher said, no, somebody's got to die. You can't expect people to get to the second last chapter and go, oh, guess what, guys, there actually wasn't a murder. So in instances like that, yes, I was forcibly brought back to genre reality, which I was greatly appreciative of. I mean, you have to, if you're not steeped in the lore of it, you do need that sort of help.
I was interested that you have come back to Johannesburg in as a setting, but in my mind you are quintessentially a Cape Town writer. Like I have you in the Cape Town writing set here. Talk to us about that decision.
So, you know, that was something that came very naturally. That wasn't a conscious or strategic decision at all. And I think it's because my experience of Johannesburg as a Capetonian is, well, my sort of gut impression of Johannesburg is of a city in which anything can happen anywhere. You know, Cape Town is incredibly regimented, social strata, class structures, you know, which is why it's so easy to parody and do these, you know, silly cliches about. But they're all based on a certain truth. And so, for instance, in Johannesburg, you know, part of what makes Johannesburg so sort of chaotic in its own way is the juxtaposition of rich and poor, of this group and that group, literally a street apart. So I felt that Johannesburg offered a kind of frontier energy, a kind of freewheeling depth of opportunity that Cape Town simply doesn't. Also, you know, in my experience, there is a sort of frontier mindset in Johannesburg in the positive sense of, like, anyone can do anything with their lives. There's none of the sort of old Cape Town snobbery of you know, the seven jobs you're allowed to have and the four families you're allowed to marry into, or else you're ruined. And I just thought that somebody like Arnold would actually have been fueled by that energy. He would have been fueled by that energy, and to his detriment, because of course Arnold thinks he's just one small one-man show away from making it to Broadway. And I didn't feel that that was possible in a city like Cape Town, where, you know, where you would, like, if you weren't, if you didn't already have your show at, like, you know, the Baxter or Theatre on the Bay, you'd kind of learned your lesson by then that it probably wasn't going to happen. Whereas I think Arnold can be freer and more delusional in Johannesburg. And then also I think the physical geography of Johannesburg allowed a kind of, again, slightly chaotic moving between places. And then, of course, the sort of the mansion where it all happens, and people have asked me if it's based on Stain City. And I have to say, well, you know, yes and no. Certainly, Stain City featured a lot in the sort of Top Billing days, when I used to watch Top Billing and marvel at the sort of architectural horrors that it revealed. So it's a sort of Stain City-esque thing. And again, like, we just don't have that in Cape Town. We don't have the here it's all very old money, genteel, you know, estates tucked away behind oak trees and in the green and leafies. But, you know, up north, you can literally have a kind of Tuscan monstrosity just pancaked down on a stretch of felt. And everyone is perfectly content with that. So I suppose it is that slightly mad, the madness of Joburg that drew me to it and freed me.
I love that.
I'm fascinated by that.
Lifelong Joburger.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that perception of Joburg. I'm like, oh, frontier thinking. Who knew? Who knew?
It's why you guys are so friendly. It's like Joburgers are ridiculously friendly. I mean, that is a cliche that absolutely holds up. Like, and I think it's because you kind of live next door to everyone all the time. And in Cape Town, it literally is a thing of like, oh, you live four suburbs south of me. So, I don't know if we should really. I mean, it's absurd. Whereas in Joburg, I think, you know, you'll just go, hey, how's it pull in? And
Tom, your publisher set you in motion writing this book. And you've talked about sort of going off in one direction and then self-correcting. And were you writing tranches and showing it to your publisher? And how do you respond to feedback generally? How do you respond to being edited? I'm sure as a column writer, it's something that's always been part of your life.
So I have never been edited as a columnist. It's one of the things that gives me pause. I've only been asked to consider an edit once when I was working with the Mail and Guardian, and I wrote something fairly spiky and nasty about something, and Ferial Haffajik phoned me and said, are you sure you want to say that? And I said, yes. And she said, okay, we'll print it. Otherwise, I send my columns into a editorial vacuum and they appear the next day as I wrote them, perhaps with a spelling mistake fixed. So I have no experience of being edited closely as a columnist. As a writer of prose, I'm learning to take editing and criticism much better than I used to. My wife Tanya is a sort of developmental editor and general editor on my work, and she's brilliant. And I've had to accept her brilliance. I've had to go, yeah. I mean, I think this is funny, and I think this works, but now that you explain it like that, gosh, okay, it was a bit of a disaster actually. So I've learned the value of a good developmental editor and a good editor. You know, they're lifesavers in a way, because often you just can't see. You really can't see. Especially with comedy. You know, if something makes you giggle that you thought of, the chances are that made you giggle because of the 17 other things around it in your brain that fueled and set up the joke. But the reader doesn't have those 17 other things, and they just think you're making a slightly lame observation about something. So I'm hugely appreciative of that feedback. In terms of my editor, my publisher, I think she wanted to see tranches more than she did, which was not at all. She was very politely saying, "Can you, have you got anything yet, maybe just to send?" And I'd go, I will. And then I didn't. You know, I think in an ideal world, I would do that. And I hope to do that this time around, you know, that the publisher sees more than just draft one. But yeah, I think I was very lucky to have this editor at home to help me along, because it can go badly wrong. And it did with this book, in fact. I mean, the first 30,000 words, when I hadn't figured out the genre stuff yet, you know, I showed it to Tanya, and I tell the story because it was important at the time. I showed it to her and watched her read. You know, you excitedly wait for them to laugh and go, ooh, ah. And she read it in total silence without twitching a muscle on her face, and got to the last page and closed it and went, okay. In that way that, you know, like, okay, we need to talk. And she was dead right. I mean, I'd missed the target by a mile. So I think editors are hugely valuable. Unfortunately, in South Africa, you know, there's no time or money to really often give books the developmental editing that they need. And I think a few things creep through that perhaps shouldn't. But in my case, I was very lucky, because it would have been a bit of a disaster. I mean, I would have sent my publisher a first draft that was not a cozy crime by any manner of means.
It feels to me, looking at your writing history, that you are one of those writers who will write fiction when the feeling takes you, but the feeling doesn't always take you. Is that a correct assessment? Is writing fiction something you feel compelled to do, or something you only do when the idea feels right for you?
Yeah, definitely the latter. I think I'm not sure that writing fiction comes that naturally and easily to me. I've learned through this last one that I've written now that it's an emotional state that one enters and stays in. And it's not a technical performance at all. It's a psychological and emotional state that you enter for many months, and for better or for worse. And I think that state is not one that I'm very practiced entering, or that necessarily gives me the euphoria that it gives other writers. I mean, I know that there are writers where it's a high, they just can't stop doing it. You know, in any extreme cases, it verges into sort of mania and addiction, like Stephen King, you know, who's been very open about how he channels his addictive tendencies into writing. And I get that, and I can feel into that at moments. But for the rest, no, it really has to feel like a good story, or a good idea, or in this case, a really fun challenge. You know, like writing a sort of a puzzle. So yeah, I think to answer your question, I do move from one to the other sort of seasonally, you know, that there, this time of my life, I'm feeling more like observation. And then my column writing is the same. You know, I've gone from, in Mail and Guardian days, I mean, I was a real bastard. Like I was very young and arrogant and opinionated, and it was based on nothing really, except youthful snobbery and insecurity. And, you know, and now with my Substack, where I'm able to write longer, I'm finding myself becoming, you know, quite serious and quiet and thinking things through. So one goes through these moods and changes. And I think the same might apply to fiction.
So An Act of Murder has been out for a little while, and you've done some publicity events, and there's been a chance for some reviews and feedback to come in. Do you feel as though the South African audience is receiving it the way you intended it, or is there that disjuncture where they're seeing things in it that you kind of didn't intend or weren't aware of? What's that feedback been like?
The feedback has been fantastic. The feedback has been absolutely lovely, in that almost everything I've heard has been that they clearly took it in the spirit in which it was written, that they were entertained, that they laughed now and then, but otherwise it was a page turner. I've really enjoyed hearing how many people couldn't figure it out themselves, you know, that they thought they'd figured it out by fourth chapter from the end, but. So no, all the feedback I've had has been exactly what you'd want to hear. I have been interested by more than one person describing it as chaotic I really didn't think it was that chaotic, but you know, different strokes for different folks. And perhaps what I consider sort of conventional feels a bit chaotic. But no, the feedback has been really lovely. Yeah. So I mean, and also I think what's delightful is that a few people have said, you know, it made them laugh. That's always a relief when the jokes land and people, and also it's interesting to see what people find amusing. You know, it's not always the big punchline you wrote, but something else, which is also always lovely to see what different readers take out of things. So no, I've been very, very happy with the feedback, and may it continue.
Tom, you touched on writing for TV and we kind of didn't stop and examine that. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into it? Because I think a lot of people dream of being able to get into writing for TV and what, how it's been different from other writing. I mean, you touched on that, but yeah.
Well, I got into it again by luck. Again, I was asked, you know, I knew somebody who knew somebody and they needed a writer. And because I don't limit myself to what I write, you know, I've worked on some fantastic nature documentaries. There was a series called Shoreline about 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, which went around the South African coast twice. It was Shoreline 1 and Shoreline 2. You know, and the lovely thing about that sort of writing is you learn so much that you didn't know. So for instance, you know, one week I'd be writing about a certain kind of barnacle that lives in a certain kind of rock pool, and the next it'll be about a shipwreck here and the history of Portuguese what there. And so, you know, that sort of writing is enormously fun. I've also done a fair amount of telenovela and telenovela daily drama sort of stuff, which is fun in its own way. You know, TV writing or that sort of writing, drama, fictional TV, not documentary, is all dialogue. You know, that's where the story comes from. It's all dialogue. And I think it does train you to understand how dialogue works. Unfortunately, my preferred brand of dialogue is dialogue that sort of drifts around the edges of the conversation. You know, I like dialogue. It's sort of English sensibility of lots of ums and ahs and quiet pauses and meaningful throat clearings, which you don't have time or space for in a daily drama, where you've got to crack on and say, well, as it turns out, you are my secret daughter that I had while I was under mind control on the island. But nonetheless, it does train you in interesting ways. And as I said earlier, you know, it trains you above all to really get on with things. So it's been fun. And I'm always eager to do more. But again, it feels very seasonal. You know, it comes and goes.
And what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on you?
So I haven't been reading much lately. I keep buying books and then not reading them. I just bought a very interesting looking thing called The Wide, Wide Sea by Hampton Sides, which is the final fatal adventure of Captain James Cook. So that'll probably be next. But I've been watching a lot. I tend to rewatch things many, many times. And so I'm rewatching Ripley on Netflix, the Talented Mr. Ripley reimagining of, which I just find beautiful in all sorts of ways. Mm-hmm. Tanya and I are also finally catching up on The Expanse, which is a good stonking sci-fi show. It tends to be between quite sort of dark crime stuff and sci-fi. Although I did also just glom out in front of the Charlie Sheen documentary last night. I find that I use TV to sort of rest my brain quite a lot. You know, I spend so much time in the week writing words and thinking about what I think about things, that to relax, I don't really want to think about more things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of TV out there that allows you to not think about things. And so that's kind of where I go. But when I read it these days, it's mostly nonfiction. It's mostly historical nonfiction. And I'm slowly, slowly working my way through, you know, Barbara Tuchman's History of the 13th Century and Anthony Beaver's History of D-Day and, you know, little bits, because I just find that relaxing.
Well, Tom, we hope that everyone checks out An Act of Murder. It's on the shelves right now, published by Penguin Random House. It is funny, it's charming, it is indeed a page-turner, and it certainly kept me guessing, and I think it would anybody. So thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and this has been delightful.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. It's been lovely. Thanks so much.
Gail, Tom is as much fun as his books. Wouldn't you agree?
I would have to agree. And, you know, I followed Tom on social media for a very long time and knew he would be fun and funny and our kind of light-hearted person. And really, really, that was fun.
It was. I enjoyed it so much. What did you take from it?
So a thing that really resonated for me was this idea of writing being a bit like exercise, in that you have a certain amount of breath for it and you learn how much breath you have for it. Mm. And I think for me, because I also see, I know that I go through stages of fitness. When I have been writing a lot regularly, writing my 500 words comes very easily to me.
Yes.
When I'm unfit, it doesn't come that easily. And I also have that sense when I'm writing of running out of breath. And then it turns out normally I'll run out of breath at about 600 words. Mm-hmm. So a bit more than I'm fit for, and then I run out of breath. So that really, really resonated with me.
I like that, yes.
What about you, Fiona? What did you take?
Well, I was interested in his reminding us of that Stephen King idea that he has this addictive personality and used to be in active addiction, and he's channeled those addictive energies into his writing.
To be clear, Stephen King, not Tom Eaton.
Stephen King, not Tom Eaton. Used to be in, well, I don't think one ever grows out of being an addict, but he's no longer in active addiction, but he channels it into his writing. So it got me thinking, is writing an addiction? Is there some kind of compulsive behavior behind it? I think for me, it certainly is an element. Mm. Have you thought about it for you?
Well, you know, I think it relates a lot to that question of why do we write? And certainly I've written for many years without becoming sickeningly rich from it or massively famous or any of those things that might from a objective point of view, keep a person writing.
Yeah.
And yet I keep writing. And so maybe that is the thing. Maybe there is an addiction. And I don't know if it's the addiction to being in another world or an addiction to the hope that the next one's going to be the one. I don't know.
I think it's both and. And for me, it's almost more compulsive than addictive, because there are times when I really don't look forward to it. I'm almost dreading sitting down with that page, but I feel compelled to do it. And if it goes well, I'll get that addict's high of, oh yay, that was great. I feel so good now. And if it doesn't, I'll still show up the next day and continue to do it. And I think we've talked about this before. I know that I would continue to write even if I was never going to be published again in my life.
And I don't know for sure.
Right.
I don't know for sure. Part of it for me definitely is the publication, but at the same time, the ideas come and the voices start in my head, not in a mad way, Fiona, in a perfectly normal way. And so maybe I would. It's very interesting. And as you're speaking, I'm wondering, because I have never had a substance addiction. I'm very lucky. I wonder if there's that push-pull, that dread of you know, like we dread writing, but we have to write. And I do wonder if you are highly addicted to a substance, if there's an element of dread, like you know that what you're doing, but you have to do it. I don't know. I don't know enough about addiction. I'm quite interested. I might read up on that.
No, it is interesting. It's something to think about. And for me, it's, we've interviewed people who've answered that question with no, absolutely not. If I was never going to be published again, I would never write another word. But for me, I know I would continue to do it.
And I always do find those people a bit mysterious to me. So I think possibly in my heart, I know I'd continue, but I would continue trying to get published.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. But it's more about the process and the outcome for me.
I have no idea. I'm going to have to sleep on this one, Fiona.
Well, if any of our listeners have read Tom Eaton's work, if you've read the most recent one, An Act of Murder, published by Penguin Random House, please get in touch. if you have thoughts on whether writing is an addiction or something you do as a duty, please get in touch with us. We are on all social media across the board and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.